I'm frustrated. I feel like it's a game that's being played right now between the Senate and the House, and everybody's being the playing game.
A legislative budget battle threatens to close the state's pioneer homes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 12th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, conservative lawmakers question Governor Walker's choice for the Human Rights Commission.
I just want to know if we're going to add another person to the Human Rights Commission that holds views that are out of step with the rest of Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Residents and staff at the Palmer and Juno Pioneer Homes, the state-run senior care facilities, have been put on notice that a budget battle in the Alaska legislature is threatening to displace them. The budget is far from complete, and some legislators say the governor and state officials are passing blame for the cuts and resorting to scaring the elderly to get their way. That blame, the state says, lies squarely with lawmakers. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove has more.
The fight over Alaska's budget is literally bringing people to tears.
Those people love my mother just like I do. Sorry.
This is Kim Kiefer, and she's worried about her mom, Marilyn, a Pioneer Home resident in Juneau.
I'm frustrated. I feel like it's a game that's being played right now between the Senate and the House, and everybody's being the blame game.
Marilyn and other seniors at the Pioneer Homes in Juneau and Palmer are at the center of a struggle over cuts needed to balance the state budget, with the Senate, House, and governor all involved. State senators recently approved their version of the budget, including a roughly 10% cut to the health department's funds to operate the Pioneer Homes. Health officials, in turn, notified staff in Palmer and Juneau, and word of the proposed cuts made it to residents and their family members, like Kim Kiefer and her mom.
Okay, do I need to start right now trying to look for a place for my mom that's safe?
It's a question that Republican State Senator Shelley Hughes, who represents the greater Palmer area, says Alaska's elderly population should not have to be asking. Hughes says it is the strategy of Governor Walker's administration to cause a stir among constituents to pressure legislators, particularly Republicans from the MATSU, to vote in support of a state income tax. Hughes says the administration has discretionary funds to make up the difference, and that the warning to Pioneer Homes was way too early in the budgeting process.
Using our frail elderly as a political football I can't even think of the right adjective. It is just incomprehensible. It's despicable.
Department of Health and Social Services Commissioner Valerie Davidson does not care for that metaphor.
I like to think that when we're talking about elders in our state, that we never refer to them in those derogatory terms.
Davidson disputes the claim that notifying the dozens of Pioneer Home staff and residents of a possible late summer closure amounted to fear-mongering. She says the residents and their families are already following the budget process closely. Davidson says the Senate made the cuts and that its own documentation shows the cuts were made directly to the Pioneer Homes. As for discretionary funds, Davidson says those are for unexpected expenses. She says the money is not intended to bridge a gap created by legislators' cuts.
It appears that to me that the Senate's intent was clear. It wasn't the governor's cut.
Hughes and other members of the MATSU delegation maintain the state has the flexibility with those funds to further reduce spending and still take care of Alaska's elderly Pioneer Home residents. In the meantime, the budget process continues as legislators try to reconcile different versions from the House and Senate. For Alaska Public Media, and with help from Emily Kwong, I'm Casey Grove.
The Senate today voted to delay a joint session on whether to confirm Governor Bill Walker's appointments. When the hearing does happen, one of Walker's appointments to the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights potentially faces a close vote. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Conservative lawmakers are raising questions about the appointment of Fairbanks resident Drew Phoenix to the Human Rights Commission. The commission drew concern from conservatives in November when it raised the possibility of interpreting the state ban on sex discrimination to include gender identity and sexual orientation. Senate President Pete Kelly says the commission is wrong to include protections that lawmakers didn't intend.
It seems they're planning to usurp the legislature's authority. And I just want to know if we're going to add another person to the Human Rights Commission that holds views that are out of step with the rest of Alaska.
Phoenix is a transgender man. He has served as executive director of the LGBT advocacy organization Identity Alaska and a fundraiser and spokesman for the ACLU of Alaska Foundation. He says commission members apply existing state law, and he would do the same.
I'm a firm believer that the better able we are to eliminate any threat of discrimination for individuals, the better off our entire state will be in terms of peace and safety and economic and healthy well-being.
Phoenix is sympathetic with the commission's position on who's covered by sex discrimination. And all four members of the public who testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee on Phoenix's appointment supported him. Reverend Martin Eldred, pastor of Joy Lutheran Church in Eagle River, says Phoenix is able to reach out to those on both sides of disputes. Phoenix is an ordained Methodist minister.
I think Drew does a good job of educating in a gentle way. He's a good friend, he's a colleague, and I think he could only help our state.
It's not clear when the confirmation session will occur. While state law says the legislative session should end on Sunday, the state constitution allows it to continue until May 17th. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Another pending confirmation vote is for the state's top lawyer. Attorney General Jana Lindemuth has asked legislators to consider her entire record in weighing her confirmation. Lindemuth appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee today, where she explained her decision to pursue settlement in a dispute over access along a road leading from Copper Center to Cloutina Lake. Atna Incorporated sued the state and argues the road traverses undeveloped Atna land. The Alaska Native Regional Corporation in 2006 scored a partial victory in Superior Court when a judge found the state's right-of-way claims to be too far-reaching. During public testimony, former State Attorney General Michael Garrity was among those who praised Lindemuth as skilled and highly qualified for the job. Much of her opposition focused on her decision to pursue settlement in the Atna case. A policy group in Anchorage is pushing for the city's two main electrical utility companies to merge. In a letter sent today to city leaders, the head of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, Bill Popp, wrote that a recently convened working group concluded stakeholders should seriously consider merging Municipal Light and Power with Chugach Electric Association. The working group is made up of 10 local businesses and organizations, many of whom are concerned about recent rate increases and growing energy costs. After four meetings and conversations with a national energy consulting firm, the group is asking city leaders to begin presenting the idea of a merger to the public. The letter, addressed to the mayor, the chairwoman of the Anchorage Assembly, and the heads of both utilities, points to inefficiencies like redundant infrastructure and problems integrating new energy sources into the grid that are contributing to higher rates. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, despite decades of fighting the infection, tuberculosis rates remain high in Alaska.
The public health nurses and the community health aides and DOT aides are out there day in and day out finding cases and treating these people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The State Department of Health says 57 cases of tuberculosis were reported in Alaska in 2016. That's a moderate decrease over the prior year, but Alaska continues to have among the highest rates of tuberculosis in the United States, more than double the national average. Anchorage Medical Officer Bruce Chandler says the high rate is to be expected given Alaska's history of the disease.
We continue to see cases crop up both in rural Alaska and Anchorage, primarily in the Alaska Native population, where there was so much tuberculosis and for the last century and a half or two.
The infection can lie dormant and harmless in a person for decades, often an entire lifetime. If it becomes active, an early symptom is typically a persistent cough. Antibiotics can cure the disease, and Chandler says keeping Alaska's TB rate under control requires a lot of work behind the scenes.
The public health nurses and the community health aides and DOT aides are out there day in and day out finding cases and treating these people.
DOT aides, or directly observed therapy aides, ensure patients take the full course of antibiotics. Chandler says their diligence prevents the spread of drug-resistant TB.
Now we don't have the tools to totally eradicate tuberculosis. So this is not a problem that's going to go away. It's something to be of concern for a long time to come.
TB rates are highest in Southwest Alaska. The rate in the northern region has dropped in recent years, but remains higher than the Alaska average. Worldwide, about one-third of the population has latent TB. Alaska Congressman Don Young is among 43 U.S. House members asking that Congress prevent the Justice Department from pursuing federal drug cases against people who are complying with their state's medical marijuana laws. Young and his colleagues have written the leaders of the subcommittee that writes the Justice Department's budget. They want the appropriations bill to say that none of the money Congress allocates to the department can be used to prosecute people for using, selling, or growing medical marijuana if their conduct is legal under state law. Congress has included similar language in appropriations bills since 2014, but it might be more controversial this year. The new U.S. Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has long argued that marijuana is a dangerous drug that should not be tolerated. Ketchikan's first marijuana retail store opened its doors to customers at about 4:30 p.m. on Monday, which was a few days later than originally planned. But the 50-plus people in line were happy to buy legal cannabis for the first time in Alaska's first city. KRBD's Layla Carey has the story.
The stated opening time for the Stony Moose on Stedman Street was 4 p.m., and the first couple people in line were there by 3. Nicholas Thayer was first and says he's eager to support the legal market.
Because then, you know, it'll kind of teach the idea of, you know, you don't have to wait like 3 hours in a parking lot somewhere. It doesn't have to be sketchy anymore.
By about 3:30, a few more people had joined the line. Among them was Jeremiah Hayward. He says legalization was a move in the right direction, so people don't have to hang out in dark alleys and buy from dealers.
So you just wanted to be out in the open.
Right, and it can be taxed and, you know, put towards schools and whatnot.
Gail Jackson was about fifth in line and said coming to the store opening meant she'd probably be late for work. She says she's happy to see marijuana finally become legal.
They used to say it's a gateway drug, and alcohol is so much more a gateway drug.
As 4 o'clock drew closer, more and more people arrived and lined up. A jovial party-style atmosphere developed with lots of jokes and speculation about what kinds of marijuana the Stony Moose would offer. Co-owner Mark Woodward came out and said they were still setting up to make sure they followed all the state requirements. He gave an update to the now approximately 55 people in line.
We'll make sure everyone's taken care of today. We have pre-rolls. We have 8 other different types. They're really good. Chem Dog, if you can get Chem Dog, there's not a lot, but from Sitka, oh, it's fantastic, okay? So be patient. We'll open the door in just a couple minutes.
Chem Dog? Well, apparently it's a well-known variety with high THC. That's the active chemical in pot that makes you high. Tim White, second in line, gave a history.
Chem Dog was found at a Grateful Dead concert. A bud was given to an old boy on the concert, and he took it back to the East Coast where he found 5 seeds. Later on, some more buds were sent to him. They had 3 seeds in them. He grew those seeds. That's where Chem Dog came from.
There was more general discussion about marijuana varieties, and then at about 4:30 p.m., Stony Moose co-owner Eric Reamer opened the door to start letting people in.
Oh, yeah. How's everyone doing?
Woo!
Yeah, sorry about the wait, everybody. It's kind of complicated getting stuff going in there, but I think we're ready. Nice. Yeah.
Right here. About it.
It's a tiny shop, so they only let a few people in at a time. The first customer, Nicholas Thayer, was ready and eager after his 90-minute vigil.
Which one has the higher THC?
The highest, yeah, the cream. Cookies and cream. God's good.
Absolutely. I'll take a pre-roll and cookies and cream and a gram of Chem Dog.
They carefully measured out a gram of Chem Dog and packaged it up in a secure pouch, then packaged the pre-rolled joint in another pouch. Thayer paid for his purchase, and there it was, the first legal sale in Ketchikan. Woodward was all smiles behind the cash register.
Eric and I were here last night late, and we were just like, can you believe this is happening?
Of course.
When the product got here this weekend, I knew now it's changed. Now my mind can actually see that this will
happen. Welcome, sir. So. Welcome to the Starting Moose.
How's it going, man?
Yeah.
What are you after today?
Camp dog.
And they moved on to the next customer, and the next, and the next, and reporting in Ketchikan. I'm Layla Carey.
The University of Alaska Anchorage Chancellor has announced his retirement. Chancellor Tom Case sent a letter to colleagues and students today saying he will leave at the end of June after 12 years with the university. Case previously worked as the dean of UAA's College of Business and Public Policy. He has been UAA Chancellor since 2011. Provost Sam Gingrich will serve as interim chancellor. Programs around the state have been under threat of closure because of budget issues, and in the city of Kodiak, the future of one seafood research and training center has also been uncertain. But that may change if a resolution to save the center passes. The Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center, which opened in 1981 as the Fishery Industrial Technology Center, boasts laboratories, classroom areas, and a large pilot seafood processing plant. Over the last few years, the University of Alaska has repeatedly said it may need to cut off funding to the institution, and community members have been fighting to prevent that. Former director of the Seafood and Marine Science Center and current Kodiak Island Borough Assemblyman Scott Smiley is part of a local group, the Alaska Research Consortium, who have been working to preserve the center and its contributions. Smiley says the center has dealt with everything from reindeer meat issues to more typical fisheries matters.
The center itself has been directed to answer questions as they come up in Alaska's seafood industry, principally. And we've worked on a whole variety of different projects.
Smiley says the facility often does damage control.
One of the things that we've been involved in, the faculty there has been involved in since its beginning, was issues of microbiology, because people can get hurt from not having the right kinds of protections built into the products.
Smiley says he, along with other members of the Alaska Research Consortium, gave input on a resolution back in February. House Concurrent Resolution 8 touches on both the center's history and its current relevance to technical and professional development within the seafood industry. Last week, Kodiak Representative Louise Stutes introduced the resolution in the Alaska House of Representatives, urging the University of Alaska to keep the Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center operating. She says the resolution will show the university the legislature of Alaska considers the center a critical part of the fishing industry.
It's a teaching center. It's a learning center. It's a processing center. It's an innovative, value-added center. It's the only DEC-approved processing center in relation to seafood. It's just, it's an incredibly valuable asset.
A press release from Stutes' office, HCR 8, passed the Alaska House of Representatives on Friday with a 40-0 vote. It heads next to the Senate.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
After being open for a record amount of consecutive days, around 3 weeks, the ice road that spans from Kotzebue to Norvik and Kiana is closed. After a snowstorm on Sunday night, several Kotzebue residents found their vehicles on the wrong side of the road. On a trip to Norvik, Kotzebue resident Robin Gage's wife, Frances, was stopped right outside of Norvik after trying to get home. Gage, who had snow machined out to the road, describes the terrain as currently impassable.
Some people were down there on the river, right outside of Norvik, and they stopped her and said, don't even go, don't waste your time, it's no good, it's closed. And so she never left Norvik.
As of yesterday, the city confirmed two vehicles are stuck on the Norvik side of the ice road. Northwest Arctic Borough Chief of Staff Patrick Suvok says the borough has no intentions of opening up the road any further.
The official status as of today is the ice road to Norvik and Kiana from Kotzebue has been blown over and is now closed. We do not have any remaining funds to reopen the road, and we are scrambling, looking at our books to find whatever we can to at least aid somewhat of it opening, as we know there's some vehicles stuck up in the villages.
Suvok says those with stuck cars may have few options for getting their vehicles home.
One has already been brought back to custody via, I think, two or four sleds and a number of snow machines. That's an option. Secondly is the barging system when the water opens. Thirdly is to, as some people have done this before in the past, leave their vehicle up there until the next year's ice road.
He says making an ice road is costly. Aside from local donations, the borough is given a $50,000 grant to help provide for car travel to Kotzebue. This year, the borough reports it has already spent all existing funds. Searchers continue looking for a seal hunter who went missing off the coast of Neutok last month. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
18 miles west of Neutok, an Arctic Cat snow machine sits by the shore. Two tents sit beside it, one for storing equipment and the other for searchers to sleep in. The snow machine belongs to 59-year-old Tom John, who was last seen leaving Neutok for a seal hunt on March 26, towing his new red and yellow fiberglass single-person kayak. Neither John nor his kayak have been seen since. Tom John grew up seal hunting, and his friends say he may be the last hunter to use a kayak to go after the animals. He learned the traditional method from his father, and despite newer technology, John continued using a canvas-covered wooden-frame kayak. John Andy, Neutok Search and Rescue Coordinator and Tom John's friend, says it's the kind of kayak you would see from the 1960s in a museum, the kind that replaced the traditional sealskin kayaks. But on March 26, the last day John was seen, John Andy says the hunter didn't take his canvas one. Instead, for the first time, Tom John took a new fiberglass kayak to sea.
Do you think it was because he used a new kayak that he got lost?
That's a question I don't know. That could be possible.
Currently, 15 volunteers from Tununak, Nightmute, and Neutok are at the search camp, leaving with the outgoing tides to look for the missing hunter. Day after day, they're dragging hooks along the ocean bottom, prodding it with poles, and screening its depths with sonar. Dozens of volunteers from surrounding communities have helped with the search. For the first 2 days, the Civil Air Patrol, U.S. Coast Guard, and state troopers looked as well. Earlier this week, a trooper came out for a day to search with an underwater camera. The day John left to go hunting was beautiful. Sunny, clear, calm waters. John Andy called the hunter a good hunter, a family provider. But the Bering Sea can overpower even the most experienced hunters.
We are told never to challenge the Bering Sea. Never underestimate the Bering Sea. Respect for the ocean, respect for the land. That's what we are taught by our elders.
Search and Rescue Coordinator Andy says the searchers are tired and stressed, but they're not giving up. They've gone out every day since Tom John was discovered missing, and they'll only stop when they find him, or when his wife and mother say it's over.
Do you still have hope that you'll find him?
That's the only way we are going, with hope.
The group is collecting donations of cash, fuel, and food to keep the search going. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Little Rock, Arkansas is probably not the first place you'd imagine preserving Alaska Native history, but the Sequoia National Research Center is doing just that. A team of archivists are cataloging more than 1,000 videotapes that showcase Native life in Alaska. As KCAW's Emily Russell reports, even the archivists themselves have ties to the state.
In Little Rock, Arkansas, on the corner of Archer and University Avenues, sits one of the largest Native American archives in the world.
You know, obviously people are thinking, why in the world is this collection of Alaska Native films in Arkansas?
Aaron Fair is the archivist at Sequoia National Research Center.
But as you can see, we do have Alaska Natives in Arkansas, although we are small and few in number.
If it's not already clear from her accent, Fair grew up in Arkansas. But her grandmother, she's Yupik from Hooper Bay. And for the past few years, Fair's work has focused on her Alaska Native roots. In 2014, the center got a $24,000 grant to digitize more than 1,200 films by the Inupiaq TV producer Jeannie Green.
Hi, I'm Jeannie Green, and I want to welcome you to the 2016 Heartbeat Alaska Christmas Special. Thank you so much for joining me.
Green has a number of series under her belt, like This Generation and Northern Lives, but she's most known for Heartbeat Alaska. This episode, it's basically like an hour-long Christmas card. People wish their families Merry Christmas, from Sitka over to Seward and all the way out to the village of Tuluksak on the Kuskokwim River. That's where a woman sings O Christmas Tree in Yupik. These videos, they're snapshots of Native life in Alaska. They're sometimes rough and often unrehearsed, but it's real life, something a lot of people can relate to.
Heartbeat Alaska, I'm sure, like, you know, as many Alaskans are familiar with, I grew up watching.
Heidi Davis is another of Arkansas's Alaska Natives. She's Tlingit and Haida and grew up in Southeast.
Mostly Cake, and then my mom moved us back and forth between Juneau and Sitka. And I lived there for 22 years until my husband and I moved out.
Her husband was working aboard the Coast Guard cutter Maple when they met in Sitka. Now the two are working towards undergraduate degrees from the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, where Davis has also been interning at the Sequoia National Research Center this semester. She's cataloging the Jeannie Green videos.
Do you ever recognize people in the videos?
Oh, yeah. Because I was so excited about it, they started out with like a lot of the Cake videos and a lot of like the Sitka videos. And I mean, a lot of the names on there are really familiar and names that I'm sure you're familiar with there in Sitka. Tommy Joseph was on one of the videos that I was watching a couple of weeks back.
Joseph is a Tlingit woodcarver in Sitka, known for his totem poles. So Davis tags that video with Joseph's name and any other keywords. The goal is to make these videos available on the Sequoia National Research Center's website. With the help from the center's other intern, Stephanie Rabideau, who also has Tlingit and Haida roots, the two should finish cataloging this summer. They're getting college credit for the work, and Davis has plans to go on to law school after she graduates next year. Growing up in Cake, she says she never could have imagined her life today.
You know, me being a Tlingit and Haida from Southeast Alaska is that I've come so far in Arkansas, and I'm working on something that, you know, ties me to my roots. So I think it's pretty amazing.
She says she hopes to move back to Sitka with her family someday. But for now, her work is what's keeping her connected to Alaska. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Russell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove, Liz Ruskin, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Tyler Stupp in Nome, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Emily Russell in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.